everybody. Welcome to On the Bima, where we chat with Jewish theater makers from around the world about their art, Judaism, and vision for theater's future. I'm your host, Danielle Levski. This podcast is brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater, a nonprofit organization made up of theater artists, theaters, and other people connected to theater to promote the creation, presentation, and preservation of both traditional and non-traditional theatrical endeavors by, for, and about the Jewish experience. Today, we're calling to the Bima Emmy Award-winning nonfiction playwright and writing teacher Amanda Gronich and theater director, playwright, and Tectonic Theater Project founder Moises Kaufman, who are both based in New York City. It's such an honor to have you as guests on our show, Amanda and Moises.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us, Danielle.
Yeah, it's so great to have you here. I'm so excited to talk to you both. And I wanted to start off by talking about Here There Are Blueberries, which premiered this past July at La Jolla Playhouse here in San Diego, where I'm based. So in putting up this production, which has evolved quite a bit since the discovery of the photo album in 2007, I read what Moises said in the San Diego Union-Tribune interview, that this play is your most American play. It speaks about how we often coexist when tremendous injustices are being committed. After you opened this production and went through all those informative talkbacks, what did you find the audience responding to the most and commenting the most upon?
The thing that everybody commented on is, even though the photographs are from 1944, it felt like it was speaking about our culture and our society today. Right. As you said, the play deals with the questions, can we light a Christmas candle and then go and work in a concentration camp? And we sing with an accordion and eat blueberries and then go work in a concentration camp? Can we do these things while we are working at a concentration camp? So this question of what was the daily lives of the people who run the camp like? And what is the difference between culpability and complicity? And I think that what the audiences fed back to us was that there was one woman who left the theater and she said, my God, there by for the grace of God go I. And that was exactly right. It's how do we make and live by an ethical system that allows us to make decisions that prevent us from doing what we are watching in the photographs?
Yeah. Would you be able to share some of the specific examples that people gave of like, this coexistence of culpability of doing this wonderful human, very natural thing, and then going to do the evil task afterward?
Well, I think one of the photographs in the play is a photograph of the secretaries who were in the offices of the administration of Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And, you know, one could say they didn't kill anybody, right? They weren't part of the killing machine itself. But every day they had to call, you know, to write to Berlin and tell Berlin how many people had arrived in each train, how many people had been sent to the gas chambers, and how many people had been sent to work. So they had to type that. So they knew everything that was happening, right? So they are complicit in the killing factory nature of Auschwitz. And in one of the photographs, they are enjoying a lovely summer afternoon, listening to accordion player, and they have discovered that in the area where they are sitting, there are blueberries. So they're eating blueberries. And if you remove what's happening outside of the frame from the context of the photo, they just seem like, you know, lovely young women who are out in a camping trip eating blueberries and singing songs. So what is that? What does that mean can you have that experience and at the same time be sending emails every day of how many thousands of people have been put in the gas chamber?
And Danielle, I would add to, you know, people saying over and over again after seeing the play, had I been born into different circumstances, I too could have been a perpetrator. And, you know, the recognition, that kind of gut level reaction is so basic and simple, right? On the one hand, the recognition that to be human is to be vulnerable, kind of dangerous and destructive indoctrination, right, that can result in evil and horrific consequences. And in other ways, it's a shock of recognition that's far more complicated. You know, it's the mandate that with this vulnerability comes the responsibility to do something about it. So how to effect real and lasting change on a personal and societal level both. This requires rolling up our sleeves and doing the hard work of trying to change the course of history as it repeats itself. You know, it always makes me think of the Jewish law of the bystander. You know, in Judaism, the bystander's duty is to come to the rescue of his fellow human who's in peril, right? And that's a religious, ethical, and legal law. And I think that that's, it's just such a fascinating question. As Moisés said, where does the, what is the line? What is the continuum of culpability and compliance and responsibility?
Yeah. I think those are both really interesting points. It makes me think of how people are approaching current wars and atrocities happening across the globe today. I mean, in particular with Iran and Ukraine, right? I feel like in our particular society, a lot of what we do as the general public is just watch these events unfold in front of us and feel frozen and unsure as to what role we should play as bystanders in a way. Right. Mm-hmm. I wonder if this came up in your discussions around the play, these current events that are can be related very, very closely to the destruction of the Holocaust, too.
All the time. It was Iran hadn't, you know, the current crisis in Iran hadn't really happened yet. So we were not talking about Iran, but we were talking about everywhere in the world where there has been, you know, this kind of events occurring. Mm-hmm. And what is our response? And the thing is that, you know, when the laws were written into Judaism that if you're a bystander, you have to act, we didn't have the internet, right? There's a million atrocities that are being committed around the world.
Yeah.
What does it mean to not be a bystander and you have to act? You act about which one and what? And how do you negotiate that? Mm-hmm. And how do you negotiate making sure that your voice is heard? And at the same time, keep a level of sanity about what do you participate in and what do you not participate in.
Definitely. I love that you...
One of the things that the audience really felt, seeing the photographs of these people eating blueberries and leading their daily lives, you know, existing in the quotidian, mm-hmm. was that everybody in that audience can relate to that. You can project yourself onto the photographs, right? Because there are many ways in which we are, right, bystanders who aren't doing anything. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, in a kind of Trumpian America, a lot of people spoke about Trump and a lot of people spoke about the current political climate in America. And that's why I call it my most American play, right? Can we stand by and watch real atrocities and, you know, children in the border being... In camps, and close our ears and minds to it. And also, but what is the difference between that and participating in it?
Right.
Like, yes, the people who, you know, the Nazis themselves had a very interesting way of kind of dealing with this. They divided the work in such a way that everybody only had to do one thing. So the doctor who selected who went to the gas chamber, he said, well, I selected who was not fit for work. Somebody else took these people to the gas chamber, right? And then the soldiers that were walking the prisoners to the gas chamber, they were saying, well, I didn't choose them, right? Somebody else chose them. I'm just moving them from here to the gas chamber. And then somebody else who was, you know, the person who was in the gas chamber waiting for the Jews, they would say, well, I only asked them to get undressed and walk in there. I didn't drop the Cyclone B. And so on and so forth, right? So the human mind, unless we have a strong ethical and moral compass that we have developed before the event, we will find ways of justifying almost everything.
Yeah.
And I have to say, too, I just want to add to that. It's such a, you know, we talked a lot about this notion of a moral compass needing to be in place beforehand. And, you know, I always agree. And that is a great deal of scholarship around the Holocaust, particularly looking at the legal framework. You know, the Germans went to great pains to make it all legal, what they were doing. So there was some notion in this sort of advanced society that making it legal protected them from some sort of not an ethical dilemma, at least a very practical framework of how they were running their society. But I also think there was an ethical framework in place in Germany prior to the adoption of Nazi racial genocide and its policies. And so I you know, the longer I spend thinking about this, I bump up against this notion that there wasn't something in place. And so what, then the question becomes, how easily are those moral frameworks dismantled? And what pushes the dismantling at such a rapid pace? Why are we willing to let go of what the values we might have been raised with when it is personally expedient for us and for our society and for our nation and our patriotic duty, so to speak, to do so? So I don't have answers to that, but I continue to think about it.
Yeah. Mm. You know, that's interesting. I think both of you speaking about moral obligations and a sense of identity and duty brings me to the question of both of your Jewish identities. How have they developed after writing this play together? What are your personal relationships to Judaism and Jewish identity now?
So super fast. My Jewish background, there's a more distant branch of my family who were completely wiped out in the Holocaust. But my grandfather's branch on my father's side is filled with these budding young professionals who emigrated from Austria in the early 30s, what was, you know, then Austria. And they were highly educated and they were highly assimilated. And, you know, of course, Vienna, the sort of cultural hub of their world at the time, at one point had been incredibly diverse, this very cosmopolitan city. So I think their story arc in playwright speak anyway, was, you know, one of first a sort of hope that systemic anti-Semitism wouldn't take root there, mm-hmm. but then giving way to the shock of realizing that no amount of privilege, no amount of contribution to society is going to protect you. And so they came to America right before the Nazi takeover, and they were surviving, you know, when so many of their compatriots didn't. And so this narrative of survivor's responsibility shaped so much of my family's story in America, and then later in Israel too, when many of them emigrated there. And so, you know, of course, I think all of this resonates so powerfully today, and certainly having worked on this play, as it, I don't need to tell anyone in our listening audience that anti-Semitism is on the rise yet again in America and everywhere else. And so, you know, where are we at this present moment? And having looked at the issues that are brought up in the play and then in my own family, where are we in that continuum? I think that every Jew is continually asking themselves this very pressing question, and we ignore it, you know, at our peril. And so, how do we act? How do we try once again, as I said, to shape history as it's unfolding? And can we change its course?
Yeah, excellent question. Yeah, wonderful insight. Moises, did you want to share as well about your relationship to Jewish identity?
Some of my family also perished in the Holocaust. My father survived the Holocaust by hiding in a basement of a building. So for us working on this, that there was something that both Amanda and I, there was something very personal mm-hmm. that is part of the experience of our ancestors. I think the reason why I wanted to write this play in particular, you know, there's been, you know, the Holocaust is one of the events in human history that has been most written about.
Right.
And Amanda and I talked a lot about what can we contribute to this discourse and to this dialogue about this event. What else can we say about it?
Right.
And the only reason why we felt the hubris to try and do that was because these photographs are new. These photographs tell us something that we didn't know before, because they show us the life of the perpetrators as they led the daily lives while they were committing these atrocities. And I think that there's something in that is profoundly new. You know, we can hear about it, but the photos allow us to see and experience the quotidian nature of their lives. You know, there are pictures of the owner of the album training his dog. Training his German Shepherd, throwing a ball with his German Shepherd. You know, that day he might have, you know, signed receipts to buy Cyclone B, but that afternoon he was playing with his dog. It is a play that really resides in the discrepancy between the quotidian and the horrific.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Amanda, I think something you said reminded me of the Jewish concept of Tikkun Olam as well. And Moises, I noticed in the San Diego Union Tribune, you talked about your goal as a playwright was to always find a way to try and bring about Tikkun Olam. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, for this particular project and also in other parts of your theater career, where has Tikkun Olam played a role for both of you?
I go back to that perspective of the perpetual outsider.
Yeah.
And I really love this idea. You know, I mentioned about how, why does our music work so well in minor keys? You know, why is that beautiful klezmer, that aching soul of the klezmer music that captures sort of Jewish, you know, experience so powerfully? I think that to the extent that the outsider can bring wisdom, the wisdom of how do we escape and change and live differently inside our given circumstances. How do we both reject and recreate and, or rather transform the story that may be handed to us? How can we take charge and retell our story in a way that reinvents it, that reclaims it? And I think that that's one of the extraordinary mandates of theater. And it's really exciting when we give voice to the voiceless, when we explore stories that have never been told before. And, you know, there's something that's very special about Tectonic Theater Project for me, in my experience, is that we ask this question, you know, how can theater tell a story in a way that no other medium can? And when you ask that question, it is, to me, it's a very similar task. How do we reclaim? How do we retell? How do we establish the stakes of our stories for ourselves and in our own voices? And how do we frame that in such a way that the audience can go on a journey they never have gone on before and change the conversation? I always think, you know, the audience comes into a theater with one conversation they're having. How do we get them to leave having a very different kind of conversation? Mm-hmm. So, and to me, that's so much of the Jewish experience.
Yeah.
To me, what's interesting about Tikkun Olam is, you know, Tikkun Olam is not a sentence that it's in the Bible. Tikkun Olam is a sentence that is in the Mishnah, which is the understanding of the Bible, right? Is the kind of erudite combing through the Bible and trying to understand the rules and the laws that are inside the Bible, right? So it is not a biblical concept. It is a concept of people studying the Bible, right? It is a concept that kind of comes up, right, when discussing issues of social policy and ensuring the safeguard of those who may be at a disadvantage,
mm-hmm.
right? That's when Tikkun Olam is born, right? When people are thinking about how do we reenact the Bible, right? So whenever you hear the kind of right-wing fanaticism or orthodoxy of like, it says so in the Bible. Like one of the things that's great about the Mishnah is that it says, wait. Yes, there's some stuff that it says in the Bible, but in the Mishnah, we're going to try and explore what it is, right? I always say that one of the most important things that the yeshiva gave me is that while in my private life, I was dealing with issues of sexuality, right?
Yeah.
Of my homosexuality, at the yeshiva, I was dealing with issues of textuality. And to me, sexuality is, you know, societally, it's a construct, right? We are who we are, and then other people have to kind of find ways of dealing with that. And textuality is a construct.
Right.
And so Tikkun Olam in that context, it becomes really, really interesting for me because theater, as Amanda was saying, has this incredible ability of putting us all in the same room, right? And addressing us. I think the theater, I think the arts in general, but theater in particular, has a higher domain than politics or the social sciences.
Right.
Because it can address your heart, it can address your mind, it can address your soul. So it can borrow from religion and political science and social sciences, and it can create an artifact that is designed to move us. And I don't mean move us emotionally. I mean move us from the place where we are, where we enter the theater, to the place where we are, where we leave the theater. And to mm-hmm. me, that is Tikkun Olam. That is the repairing of the world, right? That is the way in which we, you know, as the people who are working with the Mishnah saying, kind of renegotiate and refine our social contract.
Yeah.
So in that sense, the theater is really, really, really well suited to do Tikkun Olam.
Yeah, I'm so glad both of you delved deeper into this concept of Tikkun Olam and what it means as our responsibility as Jewish people and what it means for the rest of the world and our responsibility to each other. In particular, I love that you brought up the Mishnah. So the one thing I wanted to talk about was how you said that in the Mishnah, we have the Tikkun Olam as a commentary on what's happening in the Torah. And you also mentioned that people are constantly citing the Torah or the Bible as reasons for their actions and reasons for what they do. And what's funny is that within the Mishnah and within all the Talmudic teachings and the ones that are attached to the Talmudic teachings, they're all constantly contradicting each other. No one agrees with each other. They're constantly saying, well, I don't agree with this rabbi, and I don't agree with this particular part of what this rabbi said, and I maybe agree with this part of what this rabbi said, but not this part. And there are so many contradictions in our text because we're constantly trying to analyze and reanalyze and reshape our understanding of our book of law.
Well, I think that it's interesting to me about that. Forgive me for interrupting you, but I think one thing that really speaks to my heart about that is that one thing that is at the heart of Judaism is the idea that argument, discussion, dialogue is at the heart of how do we create a more just society and a more just world. And this idea that the Bible is a text that is meant to be analyzed, meant to be discussed, meant to be taken apart, meant to be a living, breathing thing that each culture at its own time has to struggle with and to wrestle with. I think that's, you know, that's what we do in the rehearsal room, right? We take a text and then we begin to fight about it.
This can't be emphasized enough.
Exactly.
I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. It's okay. We're having a conversation. And then overlapping conversation is also a very Jewish cultural thing. So that's okay. Something I wanted to point out too is the whole idea behind repairing the world. It's a commentary that the world should not stay stagnant or stable, that it's constantly shifting and changing. And I think what you've both done with your play here is that we're, you know, reintroducing the topic of the Holocaust from a new light. And yes, these stories have been told dozens and hundreds of times. But the point I'm seeing here is that there's always a way to re-examine and reframe the events of history and the events of our past stories in the light of today, which is what you both talked about creating for your audience.
Yes, and furthermore, you know, the Holocaust is not the past.
Right, yeah.
The Holocaust is our past, our present, and our future. It's not only as Jewish people, but as humans in the world in this day and age.
Yeah.
Right. That's what's happening in Ukraine.
Right. Yeah. Genocide isn't over just because the Holocaust is over.
No. And one of the things that we did in casting the play was that we didn't only cast it with white people. We cast it with black people. We cast it with Asian people. And the concept behind that was, you know, genocide is not the sole territory of white people.
Right.
There are genocides against every minority. And I think that was an attempt to have it talk about that.
Yeah, I agree. I wanted to say one more thing about what we were just talking about here, and then I'll move on to my next question, which is something that Amanda brought up a little bit earlier. The idea of like constructs and the idea of shaping any relationship we have to identity or our understanding of humanity or the world, all of it is a construct, right? The way we respond to something is our own construct. The way that we think about who we are in gender and sexuality and personality, et cetera, it's all a construct. I think what is interesting about what you both have said is that by attending theater, by participating in theater, we reconstruct the ways that we think about the world, the ways that we think about tragedy, atrocity, the ways we think about Holocausts. So yeah, I thought that was an interesting point because it relates to everything. So just zoom out a little bit to what you were talking about earlier. You had mentioned Tectonic Theater Project and working together with Moises for a really long time. I mean, you've been a charter member of the Tectonic Theater Project, directing Gross Indecency and being a member of the original group of theater artists. I'm curious to see over the process of the Tectonic Theater Project, what are some changes you've seen during your time?
The beauty of longevity is that you can see patterns emerge. So in some ways, I'm inverting your question. I see more similarities in some ways than a story of change. I see a great commitment to sort of standing principles. And as the years have gone on and Tectonic has tackled an ever-broadening breadth of subject matters, to me, there's always this consistency to what we do. And it does. It comes back to that question of how can theater tell a story in a way that no other medium can. But at the core of our training, the Moment Work Institute and this methodology that Tectonic has adopted, which is to really look at how theater can be made in this marvelously collective, very open, very flexible and creative framework, is to say, how do we continue to push the boundaries of what each story is asking in how it can be told? As you begin to work on a piece, you begin to, the story itself starts to tell you what it needs. And I think that Tectonic has been certainly devoted always to listening, to training our ears, to hearing what the story is telling us of how it wants to be told, and in whose voices and in what theatrical contexts and frameworks and forms. And, you know, that's so much of what we're about.
Yeah. Wonderful. That's really interesting to hear too, because I noticed too that the organization is starting to move towards producing work as well. So I wonder how, given this new chapter you're introducing into the Tectonic Theater Project, how have your own Jewish identities allowed for certain perspective shifts in the growth of the entire project based on the similarities, the patterns you found, but also maybe any new discoveries you've made along the way?
I don't know that there's a real, like, concrete answer to that. I think the only thing I can say is that coming from a Jewish home, there's a very specific idea of what family means. I know when my father immigrated to Venezuela, the Jewish community immediately, there were a lot of Jews coming from Eastern Europe in the 40s, in the late 40s. And, you know, they would give jobs to other Jews and they would help each other and they would, you know, there was that sense of security. I think that the Tectonic is a bit like that. It's a bit of a space where, you know, the company's 30 years old. You know, I've known Amanda for more than half my life. And there's a sense of family that happens in the company that is nurturing.
Yeah.
I think, too, I would add to that, and that I couldn't agree more, really. You know, Moises is like a brother to me. I'm an only child, so I really wanted one. And he was the one that got sent, and it was perfect. But I think, too, there's something very... To me, if I could claim a Jewish identity, there's like this perpetual culture of seeking, this notion that there really is never any rest. There's always work to be done, you know, and on my better days, I'm excited by this, not exhausted. What time is it? Right. But the sense that there really is what's next, you know, there's that wonderful question, you know, what's next? And I think that is such a Jewish experience of kind of pushing the envelope to see what else can be explored and told.
Yeah. I wonder, what are the next stories that you're eager to explore and unfold?
I mean, I'm particularly interested in how young people around the world are experiencing their lives as Jews. Mm. You know, what are the culture shifts? What are the stories emerging from their life experiences? People in their teens and 20s, you know, how do they see themselves and the world around them, both in their own understanding and experience of their Jewish identity, but also kind of how they see themselves in the larger community of the world around them. And I think there's a huge play to be made in, you know, young Jewish experience and the stories that are actively unfolding for them in real time in the 21st century. I'm enormously interested in that.
Yeah, that is quite an interesting topic. I agree. There's so many identities and explorations that have been found simply thanks to the advent of the internet, mm-hmm. the amount of forums and groups that have allowed young people to explore their Jewish identity in a myriad of ways, and also in very niche ways. Like, you can find a specific Jewish group that also aligns with your gender identity and your sexual identity and like your interests outside of work. You can find something that relates to where you're from or where your ancestors are from. And it's so specific and allows for so much discourse. Yeah, I think there's definitely something big to explore there.
I also just want to add one quick thing about, you know, one of the other things our play explores is, you know, I'm always struck by how Jewish law approaches willful ignorance, right? The notion that this cannot be an excuse, that it's our responsibility to seek out knowledge, to educate ourselves on the principles of justice and to live accordingly, right? To me, that's such a crux of Jewish life and identity. But, you know, one of the things our play looks at, and this relates to the current generations, what happens when you apply that law to descendants of Nazi perpetrators, in particular, third and fourth generations, you know, people in their 20s and 30s today, you know, they, of course, were not direct participants in the Holocaust. This question fascinates me. So the contemporaries of young Jews today also are telling the story of the perpetrators, in this case of the Holocaust, the German Holocaust. But as an extension of it, you know, one of the arcs in the play is a story of Tillman Taub, and he's a German businessman that we interviewed who discovered his own grandfather in the pictures of the Hawker album. And he embarked on this odyssey to try to understand what had brought his grandfather, who was a Nazi doctor, to Auschwitz, and what did this mean to his larger story. And Tillman is an amateur historian in his own right, and he excavates as much as he can of Nazi history. And his point is that, you know, he frequently meets with other descendants to try to discover what their families have kept hidden, what secrets, you know, lie buried in their closets, literally, what truths have they tried to silence and to keep from future generations. But if you're unwilling to stay ignorant, that question becomes huge. What is your personal responsibility to the telling of history? You know, what must you contribute to the understanding of how your family's story unfolded? And what must you acknowledge within yourself? What happens when you don't have the luxury of distance, when you can't safely protect yourself behind many degrees of separation? And I find that really hugely compelling. So to me, the story of Jewish identity in the 21st century, and it incorporates what you were describing, Danielle, about how much access we have to history, how easy it is now to find your family tree in a way that they're, you know, and to connect with people across the world.
Right.
I wonder if the coming generations are going to be dealing with reckoning it with history in a way that has never happened before, that is very much made possible by all of these ways we are interconnected. I'm very interested to see how that sense of the past begins to change.
Yeah, beautiful. That is so insightful and interesting. It makes me think of a number of things that I feel like we are running out of time to get into today. In particular, what comes up for me, I'll just quickly mention it, is the descendants of those who colonized the land of the United States, right? Thinking about what we've taken for ourselves, and as Jewish people who have shown up on this land that also doesn't quite belong to us, but no land has really ever belonged to us. How are we complicit? There's so many interesting questions around history and ownership and connection to violence and violence inflicted on others and violence that is inflicted onto us. Yeah. Thank you both for such a fascinating conversation today.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been a joy to talk to you.
Truly. Thank you so much, Danielle. These are great questions. I hope they spark lots of further conversations.
Yeah. I think we've generated a whole list of additional questions for people to think about, which it means we're doing it right.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Amanda and Moises. And thank you, listeners, for tuning into On the Bima. A special thanks to Danny Debner, our technical producer, Ilya Levinson and Alex Kaufman, the composers of our theme music, and the entire Alliance for Jewish Theater community. This podcast was brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater. If you like what you've heard today, support this podcast and all of our initiatives towards connecting Jewish theater makers by making a tax-deductible donation to Alliance for Jewish Theater at alljewishtheater.org or joining as a member. Make sure to give us a review on iTunes and learn more about us at alljewishtheater.org. I'm your host, Danielle Levski, and I'll chat with you next time. L'chaim.